Last week we came to the end of chapter 8 in Sefer Shmuel. I just want to read the last three psukim and really an overview of the chapter. The chapter really discusses the wars that were waged by David. And he waged war with the Plishtim to the west, the southwest, with Edom to the southeast, Ammon and Moab. In the north, he waged war with Aram Tzova and Aram Naharayim. Beginning with Pasuk 15, Vayimloch David al Kol Yisrael, this part of the Pasuk had already been said earlier, a chapter or two earlier. It's sort of the beginning of the chapter, and the beginning of the story and the end of the story is Vayimloch David al Kol Yisrael. David ruled over all of Israel. Vayihi David Ose Mishpat Utzdaka L'chol Amo. This becomes the hallmark of the house of David, that David does Mishpat Utzdaka L'chol Amo for his entire people. Mishpat, of course, represents the relationship between men and fellow men. David is not only king, but he is also Dayan, he is judge, he is Shofet, and his justice is tempered with tzedakah, with charity and with goodness. This, as I say, is the hallmark of the house of David, and we will see more about that further. Rashi over here brings that in the next pasuk it says, V'yoav ben Tzruya ala tzavar. Yoav ben Tzruya was in charge of the army. So the Gemara says the reason why David was able to do mishpat to tzedakah is because Yoav was the commander-in-chief of the forces. It worked two ways. Why was Yoav ben Tzruya successful on the field of battle? Because he is waging the wars of a king who is a man of mishpat u'tzedakah. Rashi says, David goram liYoav lihiyot matzliach al hatzavah. David is the one who causes that Yoav should be successful on the field of battle, because David is a king who's osa mishpat Utzdaka, and Yoav is the one that made it possible for David to do Mishpat Utzdaka, because Yoav was the one who carried out the decisions of David. In other words, there is the legislative branch and there is the executive branch. David is the legislative branch. Its success is because there is an arm that executes that which is decided upon by the king. Yoav and David together made it possible for Yoav to succeed in battle and for David to be able to do Mishpat Utzedakah. V'Yehoshaphat ben Achilud Mazkir. Yehoshaphat ben Achilud was the Mazkir. It's not clear precisely what it was that the Mazkir did, but it would seem from some of the Mefarshim that he kept a history of the house of Beit David. We have it a number of times in Tanakh, and I think we have it by Ahasuerus. Balayla hahu nodad shnat hamelach, the night on which the king cannot sleep. So what does he command? That they should bring Sefer HaZichronot, in which are written all that has transpired with the king. And as they're going through the Sefer HaZichronot, they find that Mordechai had saved the king's life, and the king wonders, has anything been done to reward Mordechai? The Mazkir seems to be the one who writes the Sefer HaZichronot, that brings to mind and reminds us of what it was that the king had done. V'tzadak ben Achituv v'Achimelech ben Aviatar Kohanim u'Seroya Sofer. Tzadok ben Achituv and Achimelech ben Abiatar were the Kohanim. They were from two different families. Tzadok ben Achituv was from the family of Eliezer. Remember, there were four children that Aaron had: Nadav, Avihu, Elazar, v'Itamar. Tzadok ben Achituv is from the family of Elazar. Achimelech ben Abiatar is from the family of Itamar. What David is trying to do, he is attempting to unify all of the forces in Israel. He's trying to remove competition. He wants to bring everybody to everybody together. And therefore he appoints the two of them as Kohanim. Yes?
How can you appoint Kohen Gadol is appointed the Kohanim? What does that mean to appoint a Kohen?
But Kohen Gadol is appointed by the Sanhedrin, by Melech Sanhedrin. And over here, what it means doesn't mean that they're both Kohanim Gadolim. One may be the Kohen Gadol who will do the service at the Mizbeach, and the other can be the Kohen Mashiach Muhammad, the chief chaplain of the army. The two of them are David Taylor's. No, but it says, the Pasuk says that these two top people are Kohanim. By the way, it's not going to work. Later on, Eviatar is going to be removed. Eviatar is going to fail David in the battle against Avshalom. When David is fleeing from the city of Yerushalayim, he's going to call upon Eviatar to speak to the Urim and Tumim and find out what's happening. And the Urim and Tumim does not respond to the call of Eviatar. So even in his attempt to unify the two families of Gehuna, he has to remove Eviatar, and it's Tzadok who remains the Kohen. And therefore, already in the days of Shlomo HaMelech, Tzadok is the one who's mentioned. Eviatar is part of the rebellion of Adoniyahu ben Chagit, who rebels and wants to establish himself as king. The Gemara also... Mara also tells us that in the struggles and the wars that David HaMelech waged, it's a Sifri in Parashat Ekev, the wars that he waged, so he went off fighting in Aram Tzova and Aram Naharayim, and Goyim who were living in Eretz Yisrael proper, and for that matter in Yerushalayim itself, he didn't wage war with them. The Gemara says the following: Also Shalom HaTorah, David did that which was not correct according to the Torah. HaTorah, Amra, the Torah said, Mishayir b'shu, Lord, that's after you conquer Eretz Yisrael proper, to you to show him l'irbosh chutzlarts, then you can go and wage war against chutzlarts. Hulo also came, he didn't do that, but he went and he waged war against the forces of the north. Vet ha-Yevusi, shoyosomach l'Yerushalayim, the Yevusi that was near Yerushalayim, he did not remove or destroy. Omalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, Samoch lepaltamin shelachol lo arashta, right next to your palace, you didn't remove the enemy. Heichat achozeru mechabesh Aram Naharayim v'Aram Tzova. How do you go and wage war against Aram Naharayim and Aram Tzova? Now, so here, first of all, he wages wars in the chapter. Number two, he establishes his kingdom. Is he open for criticism? Yes, he is open for criticism. Nobody is perfect. David is not perfect. I'm preparing you, of course, for what is going to come. We're going to have a 3-4 program that I'm going to deal with David and Bathsheba, and I want to get at least up to that today, so that by next week we can go into David and Bathsheba. What happens over here in this chapter as well is the following. What the chapter has, the entire chapter has been, is the fulfillment of a prophecy. The fulfillment of whose prophecy? The fulfillment of the prophecy of Bilam ben Peor. Bilam says, "Et enu velo ata, I see him, but it's not right now. Ashurenu, I espy him from the distance. Velo karov, it's not close. Dorach kochav me Yaakov, a star goes shooting out of Yaakov. The kum shevet me Israel, and a ruler arises over Israel. Umachatz, he will crush Patei Moav, the land of Moab. The karkar kol b'nei Sheit, destroy the sons of Sheit. V'haya Edom Yereisha, he will inherit Edom. V'haya Yereisha Seir Oyevav, he will destroy his enemies of Seir. The Yisrael Oseh Choyel, Yisrael is going to do great things during his time. He will destroy Reishit Goyim, the first of enemies of Israel, Amalek." Everything that Bilam had said was about David. He saw prophetically what David was going to do, and in this chapter all of that has been fulfilled. Following his wars, he establishes a government, and as we have here at the end, we have the list of the members of that government. The final pasuk is, B'noyo ben Yoyada v'hakreti v'hapleti. Who are the Kreti and Pleti? B'noyo ben Yoyada is going to appear a number of times. He is one of the mighty ones of David. The Mefarshim give a number of pshatim on the on the Kreti Upleti. There are those who say that the Kreti Upleti were his palace god. The personal god of David HaMelech, and the Mepharshim say that Kreti Upleti either describes their profession. Now, how were they the palace gods? Targum Yonatan Ben Uziel says, Kreti Upleti, Kashotaya, Vikalaaya. Kashotaya are archers, Vikalaaya are those who use the slingshot. Here are his elite force. There are those who say Kreti Upleti, as we say, are the personal god of David. There are those who say that they are called Kreti Upleti because they came from a place called Kreti or from a place called Pelet. Chazal tell us that the Kreti Upleti were the Sanhedrin and the Urim V'Tumim. The Sanhedrin, because the word Kreti comes from the word Lichrot, to cut sharply. The words of the Sanhedrin were words that were decisive and cutting. Once the Sanhedrin spoke, there was no question about the matter. And Pleti comes from the word Pella, a wondrous form of communication. What is the wondrous form of communication? The Urim, the Tumim, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. And the idea is the same. When the Urim, the Tumim speaks, then we have a statement that is definite, precise, and exact. So Benoyot Ben Yoyada is in charge of either the palace god, or, well, let's say that David has two kinds of gods. There are those who guard his body, and there are those who guard his neshama, in a sense, the Sanhedrin and the Urim V'Tumim. All right, so this is the chapter that has established David as Melech. As it says again in this chapter, Vayimlach. Chapter 9 is going to be the last one before the beginning of the story of David and Bathsheba. And what's going to happen in chapter 9 is an example of David's Mishpat Utsdaka. But more than that, he goes beyond Mishpat Utsdaka. Here, David HaMelech does Chesed, an act of great loving kindness. Vayomer David. Yes? Oh, Kohanim, Kohanim is a term that does not necessarily mean Kohen as priest who serves. Kohanim means positions of importance. Yes, serve. Yes, that's very good. Yeah. Lechahen, to serve. One can serve, Kuhunato shel Ehud Barak is coming to an end. Kuhunato, in other words, the period during which he has served. It's a form of service. All right, let's go. Chapter. Vayomer David. David said, "Hachi yesh od asher notal beit Shaul. Is there anybody else who is left from the house of Shaul? Ve'aseimo chesed. I will do him kindness. Ba'avur Yonatan, because of Yonatan. David does not forget the covenant in the name of God by oath that he had entered into with Yonatan, that there will be a treaty between them forever and ever after. So he therefore wants to do an act of chesed. Now we have to understand, in this perek we're going to see the word chesed meaning a number of things. Usually we assume that the word chesed means something that one, it would seem to be something that one is not obligated to do, and one does it as an act of great kindness. You don't really deserve it, but I'm going to do it for you anyway. That's not so. Chesed in Tanakh has a number of meanings. First of all, chesed, the word chesed means love, an act of love. Famous pasuk in Yirmiyahu, Zocharti lach chesed liyurayich ahavat kelulotayich lechtecha charay b'midbar. He's looking for somebody with whom he will do chesed. Chesed also means loyalty and faithfulness. A Rebbe has chassidim. Very good. A Rebbe has chassidim. All right. Where do we have it in Torah? We have it in Torah. Wow. I needed a chumash, you see? I did a chesed for you and I had a chumash for you, Rachel. And I just needed this chumash right now. So here it is. In Parshat Zot HaBracha, so when Moshe Rabbeinu blesses the tribe of Levi, he says, Ula Levi Amar, and to Levi he said, Tumecha V'urecha Le'ish Chasidecha. Your Urim V'tumim go to the people of your chesed. What chesed does Yaakov Avin, what does Moshe Rabbeinu describe? Ha'omer lo'aviv u'le'imo lo're'itiv et echav lo hikir. The ones who rejected all and remained absolutely loyal to God. When Moshe Rabbeinu, after he comes down from the mountain, Jew, he's told that Jews have worshipped the Egel, so he says, Mila Hashem, Elihu is with God, join me. And Levi goes through the camp and destroys those who worshipped the Egel. Could we call that an act of kindness, or is that an act of loyalty, being faithful? So, you see, because I want to get away from the meaning of the word chesed as an act of kindness, since it says in the pasuk, Bavur Yonatan, because of Yonatan. Because of Yonatan means that what he recalls now is an oath, a covenant that he entered into with Yonatan. This is something that he feels obligated and compelled to do. It's not simply something that he does as a result of the goodness of his heart. Why does he have to ask, is there anybody of the family of Shaul still alive? Let's not forget, David is a member of the family. He's a son-in-law. If anybody is left, they are either brothers or sisters-in-law of his, or they are nephews and nieces. How is it that David doesn't know? And what he's really doing is, he's beginning an investigation to find, does anybody still remain from the house of Shaul? It's his mishpucha, he should know. From the Perek it becomes quite clear that they have gone into hiding. They've gone into hiding because as David becomes stronger, what they are afraid of is that David may very well find an excuse to remove them, as was of course the commonplace, to remove anybody who might conceivably be a threat to the Malchus. Who would be a threat over here? The house of Shaul. So they've gone into hiding. Therefore he asks, Hachi yesh od ashenotah lebeit Shaul, is anybody left from the house of Shaul? Ve'esei mo chesed barbu yonatan. Ulebeit Shaul eved ushmo tziva. To the house of Shaul there was a servant whose name was Tziva. Vayikru ulo al David, they called him to come to David. Vayomer ha-melech elav. The king said to him, Ha'atat Tziva, are you Tziva? Vayomer, he said, Avdecha, I am your servant. That's the correct way in which to speak before the king. You don't say, yeah, yes, I am Avdecha, your servant. Now watch, one of the things that we try to look for in the first pasuk and in the second, he's referred to as David. In the middle of the second pasuk, he becomes Vayomer HaMelech Elav. Yomer HaMelech Elav. I believe the reason for this might be the following. When David searches for people from the house of Shaul, what he really wants to do is repay a debt that he had accepted upon himself when he was a commoner. When he entered into the relationship with Yonatan, he was not a melech. And therefore he remembers the days that he was yet David, not melech. And he had made an oath, he had taken an oath that he was going to protect the house of Yonatan forever. When he speaks to Tziva, of course, it's a completely different relationship. He is king who's speaking to servant. Now that Tziva is standing before David, and by the way, there before we talk about what the meaning of the word Tziva is, I believe in Aramaic, Tziva means to do one's will or one's wishes, Ratzon. I don't know if you ever, I don't think anybody ever hears a ksuba that's written under the, that's read under the chuppah. Usually it's mumbled. Maybe you should have read your own ksuba. In the ksuba it says, "V'tzovilei that the chosen tzovi tzadik bet yud, of his own free will he adds so much and so much to the for the Ksuba. Tziva is a classic kind of name for a servant, because he is the one who does the will of his master. So the king said, is there anybody who remains from the house of Shaul? And I will do with him chesed elokim, a chesed of God. What kind of an expression is this, chesed elokim? There are three pshatim in the Mefarshim. One is a great chesed, is called chesed elokim. Like we have, mighty mountains are referred to in Tanakh as Harerei El, the mountains of God, godly mountains, great, majestic, big. So chesed elokim is a great chesed. Chesed elokim can also mean the chesed that I'm obligated to because of the oath that I took in the name of God. A chesed I must perform because of the oath I've taken to elokim. Or chesed elokim is a chesed in which he wants to emulate God. What does it say in the Torah about God's chesed? Ose chesed la'alafim. God does chesed to thousands of generations. A long-term chesed. Something that is similar to the chesed of God. Tziva said to the king, there is a son that remains to Yonatan who is lame. We had learned a few prakim earlier that when they were afraid that the house of Shaul was going to be destroyed, so he was a little boy, and his nurse took him and ran with him, and he fell, and from that time on he was lame. So the king said, Eifohu, where is he? Vayomet Tziva l'amelach. Tziva said, Hinehu beit machir ben Amiel below Davar. Machir is from the family of Menashe. This is on the other side of the Yarden. This is clearly an indication that he has gone into hiding. He fled. In a place called Lo Davar. Lo Davar is not far from Rabat Amon, from Amman. The king sent and brought him from the house of Machir. Mephibosheth, the son of Yonatan, the son of Shaul, came to David. He bowed down. David said, Mephibosheth. He calls him by his name as an indication of the fact that he wants to bring him close. There's an intimate relationship. And he said, Hinei avdecha, behold your servant. David, al tira, do not be afraid. This is the proof, I would say, that what we were saying before is true, that he had gone into hiding. He's therefore he is there from the other side of the Yarden. He's fled. David expects of him to be frightened, and therefore he tells him, "Al tira, don't be frightened. Ki oso ese imcha chesed, I'm going to do with you chesed b'avur Yonatan avicha, because of your father Yonatan. V'ashivoti lechad kol sedei Shaul avicha, I will return to you all of the fields of Shaul your father." Of course, it's not father, it's grandfather, but the term avicha is used even with regard to asaba. V'atat tochal lechem al shulchani tamid, and you will be of those who eat bread upon my table constantly. What really happens is the following. Shaul was not a wealthy person. When Shaul became king, he was like all other Jews. There was the ancestral home that had been their portion in the land. As king, of course, he is able to amass through all sorts of legal means. Through all sorts of legal means, there are lands that become the lands of the king that he needs for his flocks, for his army. There are other lands that are expropriated by the permission and the rights that are guaranteed to a king. Shmuel had said it in chapter 8 in Shmuel Aleph, when he told the Jewish people, listen, if you want a king, you're going to have to know that the king has a right to expropriate lands. Shaul now, therefore, had owned two kinds of lands. There were the lands that he owned as part of his ancestral home, to him as Shaul, and then there are lands that became his property that were his because he was Hamelech Shaul, King Shaul. What happens to the lands that are his as king?
That goes to David.
Which means David is going to do two things for Tziva. He's going to give him the ancestral lands that always belong to the house of Shaul, but more than that, the lens that the king shows as king, which now by right have come, become the property of David, that too he is going to give to Mephibosheth, something that he would not have been obligated to do at all. Vayishtachu, so he bowed down to him. Vayomer the Malbim here says that the two great chasadim that he has done is that he's giving him the lands that were Shaul's by his right as king, and also that he's going to eat, be a member of the elite group of the Jewish people that are going to eat upon at the table of the king. So it says, Vayishtachu, he bowed down, thanking him for the lands. Vayomer, and he said, Me'avdecho, what is your servant? Why do you give me this second chesed? I am unworthy of it. Ki fanita el hakelav hamet, you've turned to a dead dog, asher kamoni, like me. Where do I come to stand, be one of those who eats upon, at the table of the king? Kelav hamet, a dead. It's used. Wait a minute. Why didn't you ask the same question when David, speaking to Shaul, says, why do you pursue a dead dog like me? Precisely the same term. Is there something fascinating about the fact that precisely how David described himself to Shaul? And he even went on to say, Parosh Echad, a flea. You're running after a flea. You're pursuing a dead dog and a flea throughout all of Eretz Yisrael. It was a measure of his humility. It's going to be used once more in Tanakh. It's in Shmuel. Here in Shmuel Beit, it's going to be used when David is fleeing from before Avshalom. So we learned it in the Haftorah. Shimi ben Gera comes out, and he is the one who curses David HaMelech. Remember, we described it in the Haftorah. They're going, David and his forces are fleeing from Yerushalayim on one hill, one mountain, and Shimi ben Gera comes out on the other mountain, and he curses David, and he says, Tzei, Ish Hadamim, go out, you men of blood. God is repaying you what you have done to the house of Shaul. So Avishai ben Tzruya, who's standing near David, says, let me cross over to the other side of the mountain and remove the head of that kelev mate, that dead dog. And of course you know that David does not permit him to do so. He says, don't let him curse. God is the one who told him to curse. Anyway, Vayikra HaMelech al Tziva Na'ar Shaul, Vayomer Elav, the king called Tziva, the boy of Shaul, and he said to him, Kol Asher Hoyol Shaul, Ulechol Beitol Antati, Leven Adonecha. Everything that belonged to Shaul and to his whole house, I have given to the son of your master. He was a servant of Shaul. The son of his master is Mephibosheth. Everything that belonged to Shaul as an individual, Ulechol Beitol, to the house of Shaul, the house of kingdom, everything I have given. Work the land for him, you, your children, and your servants. Bring it that it should be for the son of your master, for Mephibosheth, bread, and he shall eat. He is invited always to eat. It doesn't really mean, by the way, it doesn't mean that breakfast, lunch, and supper, comes a little too familiar in the house. What? Full board, yeah. That what it means. What it means is there was one meal during the course of the day that people were invited to, or people would come after they ate at home, they'd come for dessert or. And just, you know, the discussions that would take place in the at the king's table. And Tziva had 15 sons and 20 servants. Tziva said to the Melech, is it possible that Tziva also, in Tziva you hear the word Litzavot Kol Asher Yitzaveh, he is one who listens to commands. Whatever your master the king will command his servant, so shall your servant do. This is David responding. David says, Mephibosheth will eat upon my table like one of the princes. Mephibosheth ben katan ushmo Micha. Mephibosheth had a small child whose name was Micha. All of those who lived in the house of Tziva were servants to Mephibosheth.
ki al shulchan hamelech tamid hu ochel v'hu piseach shtei raglav. Mephibosheth lives in Yerushalayim because he's always a welcome guest at the house of the king. Because he is nechei raglayim, because he cannot walk, therefore he lives in Yerushalayim so that he should be close to the king. Yes.
Is there some significance in the fact that it's repeated so many times?
That what?
This whole thing with having been eaten in the house of David, and it's repeated about 5 times.
Yeah, it's all my fault. Because I trained you to see these things, and so now I have to have an answer. So what happens if I don't have an answer? The simple thing that I would say is we're talking about a chesed elokim. We're talking about a tremendous, tremendous chesed. David is trustworthy. David can be depended on. We have to have a picture of David before we begin the next chapter. We have a picture of David as Oseh Mishpat Utsdaka, a man who will not betray a friend, somebody who will go out of his way in order to remain loyal, trustworthy, kind, and good. And it is against the backdrop of this picture that we have painted of David that we have to begin the next chapter. Yes.
Such good friends, they really loved each other. So why would he do this for his son?
Oh, you know, he could very well have given him a pension from Bituach Leumi and leave him wherever he's living. He could very well have returned to him the ancestral piece of land that belonged to Shaul, but he is under absolutely no obligation to give the vast lands that Shaul received as Melech. They should go to the Melech. He's going out of his way. The word chesed, I believe, appears 3 times in the chapter. The last one means chesed for chesed's sake, not merely loyalty, not merely being trustworthy, but he has gone well beyond what would have been required. Huh? Yes, that, totally chesed. Absolute shalomet, yes.
That's something
to do with the fact that he was
careful?
I'm sorry.
So sorry for him? Or
he felt
that he could do it with him, there was no threat?
There was no threat there. I like that question. No, I like that question. Because the Pasuk before said that Mephibosheth has a small son by the name of Micha. Could you please tell me what in heaven's name that adds to our parsha? Huh? No. Micha is first of all going to be about 200 years later, and he's going to be spelled with a hey at the end. Why is that mentioned?
Because he could be an heir.
That's right. He can be an heir. He can be a threat and David, despite that. You know, it's there's the beginnings. A house of Shaul that has been decimated still has a future. By the way, what's very fascinating. What's very fascinating is, in Divrei Hayomim, they're going to give us the family of Micha, his children and his grandchildren, within 2 generations, the family of Shaul. The Navi says, Marbim Banim, many children. There's a blessing that comes down upon the family. It's mostly the idea that even when it seems as though all is lost and it's all over, just as long as there's a thread, as long as there's a thread, can never, never be certain. In other words, the house of Shaul had received its punishment, but that's it. Finished. Now, Mephibosheth, Micha, are going to be blessed with a large family, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. And there are at least 4 or 5 psukim twice in Devarim that tell us the family of Micha. So I'm saying there are 2 things. Number one, it seems like a family hanging on a thread. And remember, there's going to be a chapter later that's going to tell us about the massacre of 7 other remaining members of the family of Shaul. So that really all that's going to remain, Mephibosheth and Micha, the destruction of the house of Shaul is not over yet. And what's really happening is that the Navi is telling you the refuah is already prepared before the Makkah. The growth and the development of that family is already, right now, in place. Micha has been born. Shmichael is going to have.
So Mordechai came from Micha?
No, Shimi ben.
Mordechai is going to come from Shimi ben Gera, who is an adjunct to the family of Shaul. So therefore I say, because otherwise the idea that Mephibosheth has a son would seem to be unimportant in the entire story, except to tell us that here is a potential threat, and despite that, David.
And obviously, he wasn't the only one left. It just said there were eight others who were left. The seventh said he's the only.
Yeah, yeah. Who are? They are very good. Thanks, good to Cassius. What was it that David asked at the beginning of the Sedra? At the beginning of the Haftorah, Perek. Vayomet David. David said, "Hachi yesh od ashenotal beit Shaul ve'ase imo chesed." Right? Then pasuk 3. That's the pasuk. Vayomer Amelach. The king said, "Ha'efes od ish lebeit Shaul." Is there still a man left of the house of Shaul? Why does he ask for ish? Because there were children from the daughters of Shaul. But children from the daughters of Shaul, their name is, whose name do they get? They get the name of their father. So they're no longer part of the husband, who is the father. Not because he's the husband. They get the name because he's the father. The children get, in other words, they are already no longer the house of Shaul. He therefore asks, is there an ish left? An ish means a direct male descendant from the house of Shaul. The only one is Mephibosheth. The ones who are going to be killed later are going to be from the daughters. So they're no longer, they are family of Shaul, but they are not Bet Shaul. Some of the Parshim says when he asks, is there an ish, not only does he mean male, is there somebody who is of importance, stature? And that really fits in what we're saying at the end. Despite that Mephibosheth is a man of stature, and the Gemara says, he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. He was called Mephibosheth Shehaya Mevayesh Pnei David B'Halacha. He was able to shame David in Torah. So we are talking about somebody who, while he's Necher Aglayim, is a man of great stature. He could be a threat. And David goes ahead and does the great chesed with him. Yes? What? Yeah, the only thing is if I'm going to say that, so therefore, yeah, I understand. You see, because there was never, God never decreed upon the house of Shaul destruction. He will lose the Malchus, but the family will remain. The family will remain. And that's why Micha is mentioned. All right. Yeah, one was Ish-Bosheth, and this one is Mephibosheth. In Divrei Hayamim, they are both called by different names. Ish-Baal, it may very well mean, I mean, far as I can say, talk about it, does it mean that they were people who were ashamed because they were off to the side, or was it because of their greatness that they shamed others with their greatness? We're not talking about simple people. We're not talking about Kindlech. All right, now we begin. The story of David and Bathsheba really begins right here in chapter 10. We're not going to get to the story until, I mean, this story itself is going to be in chapter 11. But the parasha Yud, Yud Aleph, Yud Bet. It's really three chapters. In chapter 10 that we're going to start now, we're getting the background. All of this is taking place while David is waging war against Bnei Ammon. Remember, Uriah HaChiti, the husband of Bathsheba, is going to be summoned back from the battlefield. Ultimately, David is going to send him back to the field of battle where he's going to fall. What battle is this? It's the battle against Ammon. So what we're being given now is, as they would say here in Israel, the Mizgeret.
There is a misgedet to the story. The story does not take place in a vacuum. There are events that are going on, and the events may very well be related to what happens. So the event is the following. And it came to pass afterwards. So this is really the beginning. As I say, the story of David and Bathsheba is going to take place. That's going to be chapter 11. Chapter 12 is, of course, going to be the great Musar. The Musar of chapter 11 and 12 will be the Musar of Natan HaNavi, who comes to him, comes to David, David's tshuva. And then the end will be the completion of this struggle with Bnei Amon. So that's the totality of these three chapters. It's, of course, a great idea to just read through the text of these three chapters. But let's begin. Came to pass afterwards. The king of Bnei Amon died, and his son Chanun is the one who ruled in his place. Always means that there is a connection between what was said before and what is going to be said now. The connection, of course, is going to come immediately in the next pasuk. The word, the key word. Vayomer David. David said, "Eseh Chesed." The chapter before was the chapter of Chesed with the house of Shaul. Here he wants to do Chesed im Chanun ben Nachash. Now we are told who that king was. Nachash Ha'amoni. Chanun, he wants to do Chesed with Chanun, the son of Nachash. Kasher Osa Aviv Imadi Chesed, David says, as his father did Chesed with me. What is the Chesed that his father did with him? What was the Chesed? So, in the first way, all of them can only cite a Maimer Chazal. The Maimer Chazal says the following, that when Shaul was pursuing David, David sent his parents and all of his family to Moab, and Moab killed them all. And one brother of David fled from the massacre, and he fled to Ammon, to Nachash. And Moab demanded of Ammon that they hand over this last member of the house of David. And Ammon refused to hand him over. That's the chesed. Understand? Refusing to hand over somebody who had fled for political, humanitarian asylum. What's interesting, of course, over here, who was the great antagonist of Shaul? The first war that Shaul waged, even before he had been accepted as king by all of Israel, was against Nachash. Chapter 11? Yes, it should be chapter 11. Shmuel Aleph says that after Shaul has been anointed, so people, and Shmuel announces that Shaul is king, there were people who shamed him and embarrassed him. They didn't pay any attention to him, and Shaul remained silent. And then it says that Nachash Ha'amoni came against Yavesh Gilad. He surrounded the city, and he said that the only way he will permit them to live is if they agree to remove each one their right eye. So they didn't know what to do, so they sent a message. A message arrived to Shaul. Shaul gathers his forces and destroys Nachash, the forces of Nachash Ammoni. He saves Yavesh Gilad, and with one stroke, he is accepted by all of Israel as king. So here, of course, you see, politics, alliances make strange bedfellows. Shaul and Nachash are the two antagonists. But then Nachash... kindness that he saves the remaining brother of David.
Maybe because of
him. That's also interesting. I'm ready to accept that maybe because of it, and that's even more important. And I'll tell you why. David has the right to feel that Nachash's motives are not because of his love for David. You know why he saved my brother? Because he wanted to send a message to Shaul. Okay, you defeated me in battle, but I'm harboring your enemy. So David might very well feel that, listen, I don't owe him anything. I don't owe him a thing. But no, that's not the way David looks at it. It makes... It to David, it is unimportant and insignificant what the motives of Nachash were.
He did me a teva. My responsibility to do him a teva back. You know where else you have a similar idea? I have a similar idea in the Sedra. In the Sedra, by Dam and Sardeya, the two makos of Dam and Sardeya, who is it that's, who strikes?
Aaron
strikes the Nile. Why not Moshe? Because number one, when his mother put him in a basket in the river, it was the river that saved him. And then the earth of Mitzrayim was the one that covered the Mitzri whom he had killed. Yeah. So there's a, I believe it's a famous, or it should be a famous essay of Rav Dessler, where Rav Dessler asks, no. And if Moshe Rabbeinu would have struck the Nile, you think that the Nile would have been upset? Right? The Nile would have been upset. And if he would have taken the sand and thrown it heavenward to make kinim, the sand for Moshe, when you needed us to cover up the Mitzri, we were there. We're talking about inanimate objects. We're talking about a domain. Does the domain, the inanimate dead object, know the difference? And we learn that this Maimon Chazal all the time says Rav Dessler, powerful machshava. The act of gratitude is not something that is a result of what you did for me. It's what I'm as an individual supposed to feel. The center of gravity of gratitude is within the beneficiary, not within the benefactor. In other words, if the purpose of gratitude is to make you feel good for something you did for me, so then of course it's only, if we're talking about a human being, you did me a favor, I say thank you, I send you a gift, I write you a note. But what happens if gratitude is something that the Torah requires has to come from the depths of the person who is the beneficiary, then it makes no difference who the benefactor was. I have to feel gratitude. So then it makes no difference whether it's an inanimate object, whether it's the river, or it's the sand of Mitzrayim. So we're saying over here, the same thing is true, and I believe Rav Dessler says this, it makes no difference anymore what the motive of your benefactor was. If gratitude is because you did me a favor, because of you, then it will make a big difference why you did it. If you did it for your own, maybe even evil reasons, then I don't have to owe you gratitude. But if gratitude is rooted in me, then your motives are absolutely secondary, more than secondary. They are meaningless. I remember having this argument with, did we as Jews owe a debt of gratitude to Nixon because in the Yom Kippur War, who began the resupply of Eretz Yisrael when they were running out of ammunition? It was Nixon. So in other words, if you recall that in the United States there were professional Nixon haters, you know? Nixon Bogey. And I had in my shul in West Hempstead, I had American Jewish liberals that Nixon was the very definition of evil. Evil was Nixon. So I said, I'm terribly sorry. According to Rav Dessler, according to our understanding of Chesed, his motives for the resupply most certainly were not Ahavas Yisrael, was not love of Jews. Especially now that we know what he said on his tapes, the famous tapes, you understand, the reflections of Nixon in the White House. So we know that he was not it was not Avas Yisrael. But he felt that it was extremely important to maintain a balance between the superpowers. The Russians are resupplying Egypt, then America must resupply Israel. That was his intention. So I was telling my Nixon haters that Torah is totally uninterested in what his motives are, because gratitude has to come from the beneficiary. I'm supposed to feel gratitude and I'm supposed to express gratitude, and it makes no difference what his intentions were. Nixon is no different, I said then. Nixon is no different than the Nile or the sand of Mitzrayim, to whom Moshe Rabbeinu felt or God is really saying, don't you strike the Nile. Aaron is going to strike the Nile. The Nile protected you. Don't you strike or use the sand of Mitzrayim, because the sand of Mitzrayim stood you in good stead. So over here, the duck, thanks for raising the idea of, yes, it may very well be that Nachash HaAmoni offers his protection to and political asylum to the son of the brother of David, the son of Yishai, only because he wants to send a message of to Shaul that, you know, I got one over on you. But to David that makes no difference. So David wants to do chesed im chonon ben nochosh kasher osa aviv imadi chesed, as his father did with me chesed. Vayishlach David lenachamo biyad avodav el aviv. So David sends two of his officers to bring a message of nichum avela, simply to console the mourner. Vayavo avdei David eretz b'nei Amon, they came to the land of Amon. Vayamu sar b'nei Amon el chonon adonayim. The officers, the princes of b'nei Amon, said to their master chonon, do you really think that David is honoring your father? Because he sent people to console him. Hello, Babur, you know why he sent those people? He sent them here to investigate the city, Ularagla, to spy. Ulahavcha. The Mepharshim say, Tupshatam Ulahavcha. Lahavcha can mean not merely spying, but looking something over very well. I don't know, imagine you buy an apple. So what do? You turn it around, you know. Now, apples maybe not, but tomatoes, you know. You turn it over, it's kastach hazayfil. So you turn it over, lahavcha, you turn it over to look at it from all sides. The word lahavcha can have another meaning. What?
Change, no?
No. Lahavcha can also mean the purpose of their mission is to spy out so that they will ultimately be able to destroy us. Vayahapoch Hashem, God destroyed Sodom and Amora. Kimahapechat Sodom v'Amora. To turn something over completely means to destroy it. Like a revolution. So they say, what do you think? David over here is sending a mission of Nichum Avelim. This is a mission of spies. Sha'ol hafchosh shalach David et avodah v'elecha. He sent his servants to you. He shaved off half of their beard, one side of the face, and he cut their uniforms in half. That means all the way down to the they were simply going with half of their rear. Bizarre, on the highest order. Oh, by Yishalchem, and he sent them away. By Agidu to David, message comes to David. By Yishlach to Kratom, and he sent messengers toward them. Ki hoyu ha'anoshim nichlami miyo. The people were very ashamed. They couldn't come back to Yerushalayim. By the way, what this means is the following. What do we learn from here? That people wore beards because they could. They had a simple answer. Simple answer was cut off the other half. Right? Shave the other half. No, but they can't shave the other half. Then they're going to come walking into Yerushalayim, two people walking the streets of Yerushalayim, clean shaven. The rest of Yerushalayim is wearing beards. So, Vayomer HaMelech, Shvu b'yerecho, stay in yerecho, ad yitzamach zekamchem v'shavtem, until your beards will grow back, and then you will return. Vayiru b'nei Amon, I mean, what we're talking about over here, this is an incident, a takrit between two nations of the worst order. This is of the worst order. You understand? People, nations don't do this to the representatives of other nations. The sons of Ammon saw that they had lost favor. There was that's a bad translation. And Nivashu really means that they a noisome odor. There was they smelled in the to David. So they knew that war. They knew that war is going to start. I mean, didn't they have this figured out? Didn't they know that they're asking for war?
Did they realize that they made a mistake or no? In other words, Nivashu to David, is that also
mean? Did they realize that they made a mistake? No, I don't know if they realized that they made a mistake. You send spies over here. This is what we're going to do with your spies.
But what they realize is, they get the feeling that David is going to respond. David doesn't have somebody in his cabinet who is always going to justify the actions of the enemy. He doesn't have a Peres. So if he doesn't have a Peres, so then what you do is, if they cut off half of the beards, this is an attack. If they kill people, this is an attack. It's not because their economy is lousy. That's why things are happening. He doesn't have an apologist. So therefore, it means war. So Vayishnuchu b'nei Yama, Vayishkiru et Aram Beit Rechov, they have to hire mercenaries. And they hire Aram from Beit Rechov, et Aram Tzova, Ezrim Elef Ragli, from the north, 20,000 men, that Melech Macha Elef Ish, 1,000 people from Macha, the Ish Tov, the people of Tov, there was a place called Tov, Shnei Mozor Elef Ish, 22,000 men. Vayishma David hears, David finds out that he's hiring Shirei Cheret, he is hiring mercenaries. So he knows already that Nachash Chanun is preparing himself for war. But Yishma David, Yishlach et Yoav, that Kol HaTzavah HaGiborim, David sent all of the army, his strongest men. By Yetzu B'nei Amon, the people of Amon went out, by Yarchum Milchama Petach HaShor. What's going to happen is the following. Imagine Amman, Rabat Amman. That's the capital city. But now, south of it is Meva. The two main forces that are going to fight David, one are the people of Ammon, coming out of the city of Rabat, the capital city. 30 kilometers south is Meva, and all of the hired guns are engaged there. They're the strong force. They're the mighty force. And Yoav now is going to be sent by David, and he has to wage war. But there are two armies. So he says like this, Vayetu b'nei Amon v'yachum ulkom v'petach ashar. B'nei Amon came out from the door, from the gate of the city to wage war. V'adam tzova u'rechov v'ishtov u'macha levadom basadeh. The other four from whom he received Adam Tzova and Rechov and the people from Tov and Macha are alone in the field. Vayar Yoav ki hayta eilav pnei hamilchama mipanim me'achor. Yoav sees that if he's going to advance, he's going to be caught and crushed between the two. He's going to be moving into the center over there with Ammon to the north and all of these forces to the south. Vayivchar mikol bechurei Yisrael vayaruch lekrat Adam. He chooses the best of his forces, and he moves toward Aram. He's moving toward the south, because the mercenaries are a stronger force. Therefore, he chooses the strongest and the best of his soldiers. That Yeter Aram Natan Biyad Avshai Achiv, and the rest of the people he gave into the hands of his brother Avshai, Avishai. Now, when it says Yeter Aram, those who are chosen by Yoav are the chosen ones. We're talking about the elite troops. Yeter Aram, the rest of the people, we're not talking about trained, well-trained troops. He gives them the hands of Avishai. By Yarok Likrat B'nei Amon, Avishai is going to move in the north against the people of Ammon. Yoav is going to move in the south against the people, all of the hired hands, the mercenaries. Vayoma. And Yoav says to his brother, "In Techazak Aram Imeni, in the south, if Aram is going to be stronger than me, v'hayitalili Yeshua, you will come to my assistance. V'im b'nei Amon yeches kumimcha, if b'nei Amon to the north are going to be stronger than you, v'halachti lo shialach, I will go to save you." And here comes one of the great psukim in Tanakh: Chazak v'nit chazak v'ad amenu u'bi'ad orei elokeinu v'Hashem yaseh hatov b'einav. I'm going to do this pasuk in justice, so I'm going to try and learn it now. This is one of the great psukim, so we'll begin next week from here, but we're toward the end of, we'll see what will happen in this battle, and as I say, in the middle of this struggle is going to come the story of David Batsheva. Really, you would be doing yourself a great favor if you just read through three chapters. This one, 10, 11, and 12. And then we'll take you on a journey through the Mefarshim across the ages, how they understand the story of David and Bathsheba. Well, of course, what do you mean? Of course, Ephrat and everything that's going on. This is a great pasuk. Chazak v'nit chazek bi'ad ameinu u'ba'ad orei elokeinu. It's orei. Isn't it fascinating that he says orei elokeinu? Who do those cities belong to? Who do they belong to? Yeah, what are you talking about? What? Expropriated, shmexpropriated, bagatz, shmagatz. Orei Elokeinu. Ole Elokeinu. And this is, by the way, all of this is taking place in Eiver HaYarden, on the other side of the Jordan, outside of Amman. All right, to be continued.